Welcome to Community Matters, a podcast about the power of music community. My name is McKeegan Voice. In an era of streaming and AI and algorithmic discovery, sometimes we forget that there are humans behind the music. On Community Matters, we're chatting with artists who share their stories and how community has impacted their music careers, especially in times of struggle. A supportive community is one of the things that inspires us to start making music and then keep making it. And this is an ode to those relationships. We hope it's a reminder of just how important people are to the music that we love. Today I'm chatting with Scott Lucas of alt-rock band Local H. Scott and three high school friends founded the band together in 1990. But by 1993, two of them had left and Local H continued forward as a duo with Joe Daniels on drums and Scott playing a modified guitar with an added bass pickup to round out the sound. Brian St. Clair and Ryan Harding would spend stints as Local H's drummer, but Scott, through thick and thin, has persisted through the whole three decades, which has seen 9 studio LPs, countless shows, a few of them opening for Metallica, and the commercial breakthrough record As Good As Dead, which was led by single Bound for the Floor, a track that reached number 5 on the Billboard Modern Rock charts. And at some point in my high school years, that single spent some time as the ringtone of my Nokia flip phone. So some 15 years later, I was excited to get the chance to speak with the guy who sang the track and to hear part of his journey. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm good. I have things to occupy myself. I feel lucky because, you know, I've kind of got stuff to do. I feel okay, and I definitely feel more hopeful this week than I did last week. So there's that.
That's good. Is there any particular reason for that?
I feel like that I'm starting to see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I feel like in a lot of places, and maybe this is wrong news or reporting that I'm getting, but it sounds like a lot of places are starting to peak.
Yeah.
And so it's not as horrible as it could have been. It's still pretty fucking bad.
Yeah.
But it's all I can say about it is that I'm starting to see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. It's just a question of what else is at the end of the tunnel before we get to the light, and that could be scary. But like I said, last week I felt like a sense of utter hopelessness, like, oh my God, this is never going to end. And now I don't feel that way. And that could just be naivete.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like really hard to tell. I'm hearing all these different things from all these different places. I mean,
you're hearing like, all right, let's start wearing masks. And then people who are telling you to wear masks, they go, well, I'm not going to wear a mask.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck, dude? You know, so nobody really knows. Everyone's go outside because if you stay inside, you might get pneumonia. You need to get exercise. And then people are like, no, don't go outside.
Yeah.
And then you go outside and people are outside and then you're like, oh, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yes.
There's a lack of a unifying message, which is the world we live in.
Yeah. Just can we all be in this together? Because we are.
Yeah. Well, somebody's always got to see an angle. And there's a huge angle to play on this.
It's no surprise. You know, people use situations regardless.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyways, I'm glad there's more hope this week. And yeah, I mean, when I saw that Wuhan was starting to open back up and it's like, well, here's ground zero. Let's see what that looks like. At least they feel safe enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is great. But I don't know how many months from now or years from now, we're going to find out what the true numbers are over in China and what the true numbers are in Russia and what our true numbers are.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a lot of stuff that nobody knows. But, you know, the only thing you can do now is just take care of each other and try to stay calm, I guess, and make sure you've got enough toilet paper.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the biggest problems that we're having right now.
This is one of the biggest problems I'm having.
Is it?
When this started to happen, we were in San Diego, and we had 4 dates left on this tour that we were in. Hmm. And so San Diego is about as far from home, from Chicago, as we could possibly get in the States. Mm-hmm. And so we had to drive all the way back. And so that took us a few days. And as we're going back, we see the mood start to shift across the entire country, and people getting more nervous. And one of the things we see every day is everyone's getting toilet paper, you know, and our girlfriends and wife, you know, they're like, oh, make sure you bring home toilet paper because there's none here in Chicago. And we're like, well, what are we going to do? Stop at every place we see on the way back, you know, and I felt stupid. I was like, I'm not going to go in and buy a bunch of toilet paper. And then you get here and sure enough, all the toilet paper is gone.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
I think it goes neighborhood by neighborhood. In a neighborhood with a bunch of assholes, I think the toilet paper is disappeared. So I know, no pun intended, but our neighborhood is full of assholes. So good luck getting toilet paper. I go one neighborhood over and it's not that much of a problem.
Well, if I find myself in Chicago, I'll pop over a 4-pack for you.
Just go to the places where, you know, it's not a bunch of panicking assholes.
Yeah, let me know where that is.
Yeah, okay, I'll let you know. I'll send out a flare.
The high school where Local H formed is in Zion, Illinois, a small town an hour north of Chicago. I asked Scott about the scene in Zion back in the early 90s.
There wasn't a crazy scene, but there were a few bands. There were bands like Lunkhead and Gainsay. Those were a couple of bands that were really trying to make a scene happen in that area. And it was, you know, it was fun for a while, and I learned a lot. It was good coming up with those guys. But, you know, there just wasn't enough of an infrastructure, I guess, to support anything beyond 5 bands that would play at VFW halls.
Yeah.
And so you kind of had to go beyond that. That would lead everybody to Chicago, or you'd go to Madison. So, you know, for a long time, we were just kind of like outside looking in at the thing in Chicago. We weren't really involved in the scene. We'd play like a few small clubs and get a show at the Metro, but we weren't really part of the thing. So it wasn't really until I moved to Chicago that I became part of, well, I felt part of anything. Before that, we'd just read the Chicago Reader and just look at those bands as something else.
So what were your goals at that time? Like, why did you start making music in the first place?
Just because I wanted to. I bought a guitar. Well, I didn't buy a guitar. I asked my mom for a guitar, and she got one. I mean, I wanted a guitar so I could write songs, and it wasn't really about being a shredder or anything like that. I just wanted to write songs, and the first day I got, I wrote a song, and you know, it's that kind of thing. I just always wanted to play music, and I can't remember a time when I wanted to do anything else. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things where I never really gave anything else a thought.
As Good as Dead is a concept album about being stuck in a small town that feels like a dead end. And thinking back to my choosing that Local H track, Bound for the Floor, as my ringtone in high school, I think that concept must have resonated with me at some subliminal level. I'm from a small Midwestern town myself, and I spent many an afternoon in high school playing my guitar and writing lyrics about similar feelings. So I asked him about the roots of that small town identity.
You know, just there wasn't a whole lot to do. And I grew up in a dry town. Hmm. And so there weren't anything like venues or anything like that. You know, it was just kind of a thing where you have to play at a house party or somebody's basement or rent out a VFW hall. Hmm. And so we did a lot of that. And then, you know, it's just a point of how long that kind of thing can go on. And plus, you just, at that age, I just felt like a fucking loser. And so all that kind of comes out, and that all comes out in the music, and that becomes part of your DNA forever. And still today, it's in the music. But it also comes from this fact that I'm not from the city, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm not from these places that are supposed to be important. I'm from these places that nobody gives a fuck about. Mm-hmm. And that instills like this sense of pride. Mm-hmm. And so you feel like a loser and you hate your hometown, but if anybody talks shit about your hometown, but you're mm-hmm. like, well, fuck you.
Yeah, you don't get it.
Yeah, so there's those feelings of resentment and pride mingled together. And, you know, it just sort of makes you become this person who doesn't take no for an answer or doesn't care what anybody else thinks. At a certain point, it's really hard to pick apart what's going on up in this head.
That all sounds pretty accurate to me based on what I was feeling at that time, at least in my own reflections of how I was feeling being stuck in a small town.
You see things, but you have a certain love for it. And, right. and then that keeps going. I mean, even with people that you don't agree with politically mm-hmm. or philosophically or on anything, or, you know, what bands suck and don't suck, you can still have a love for those people that kind of like, it's like, okay, you know, I know where you're coming from and we're not that different.
And that really resonated with me, having lived through something similar, growing up in a small community and then moving into larger ones. And I think it's so important to advocate for the reality that there really isn't that big of a rift. We're not that different. But somehow we've developed this idea that there's more that divides us than doesn't, even though we all have the same basic human needs and the same ultimate human goal of being happy. I asked Scott how his mindset and communities changed with the arrival of their second record, that commercial breakthrough, As Good As Dead.
The thing was, we were in a pretty precarious position right there, where like we'd put out a record on a major label that no one gave a shit about. And so that second record could have been it. And, you know, we had nothing else going. So the whole thing could have fallen apart. So it was one of those things where we just like, let's just give everything we have to this record. Let's not hold anything back. And just started touring for that record a few months before it came out and just working really hard. And then things happened. Things started to connect and click. And at that point, it was really just all about survival. It's really hard for me to comment on how things changed because I honestly just had my head down the entire time it was mm-hmm. working. At a certain point, I knew that we were going to get to make another record, and that's really all that mattered to me. Mm-hmm. So after that point happened, after we sold enough records that it was a foregone conclusion that we could make another record, mm-hmm. I quit counting, and I just started to try and enjoy myself.
Was there a moment when your head wasn't down and you took a look back and said, wow, this is where we are now, this is where we were then?
Yeah, but that wouldn't have happened until years later when I think we were doing like 25th anniversary type of stuff.
Okay.
And then it was like, oh shit, you know, or like years after the fact when we were doing a 7-night stand and we were playing our first six or seven records. And then you sort of have to relearn your old stuff. You start to get a sense of, hey, this is where things have happened. But, you know, I mean, the third record, you're thinking, oh, this is a great record, and then your label falls apart. And then the fourth record, you get a new drummer, you get a new label, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're working your ass off to make that work, which is good because it's always been about the work. And mm-hmm. so I feel like the work doesn't suffer. We get to this point where this is our ninth record, mm-hmm. and it's just as good as anything we've ever done. And that's mm-hmm. only because we never really got big and we don't have a bunch of people kissing our ass. It's still about trying to make a great record, mm-hmm. not pushing a record out so we can go on tour and take everybody's money.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of there always being something there, you're the only one to last all 30 years of Local H. Were there some low times when you ever thought of calling it, or was this just like, this is my thing?
There might have been a couple of times, but nothing really that lasted more than a day. This is it. I got to a point where the music I was writing sounded a certain way and I'm playing a certain way. When people tell you to hang it up or they tell you I'm done, you're gonna have to go on with or without me. And it's kind of like that sort of feeling that you get that I was talking about earlier, like, well, fuck you, I can do this, you know? And you just get hard-headed and stubborn and you go, watch this. And then, you know, you take your best shot and it lands or it doesn't.
The ninth Local H record, Lifers, came out a couple weeks ago, It's their first album of new material since 2015, and it features an all-star cast of collaborators, from Julian Hatfield to Dirtik's John McCulley to legendary engineer Steve Albini, who's worked on records by Nirvana, Pixies, Joanna Newsom, and Iggy Pop, to name a few. I was struck by one of the new LP's press releases when Scott described the album's origin. He talked about how the re-release of the Beatles' White Album led to a re-obsession with it, specifically about how it felt like a concept album but technically wasn't, and he wanted to do something like that with Lifers. This might be a concept record about the end of the world, he said, or it might just be a party record with loud guitars and cowbells. And after listening to it a few times, I'd say it's probably somewhere in the middle. So I asked Scott about that vision and the creative process.
Every time you're thinking about what the next record's going to be, for me, I'm always just trying to find a concept. And so for As Good As Dead, it was like, I'll make a concept record about my hometown, you know? Mm-hmm. And once you make the decision to do that, the rest of it comes pretty easy. You just need that first step. And then you start going, okay, I'm on this rock. I know the next rock I got to jump on is over there. And then before you know it, you've got a record. With Lifers, it was this thing where the initial weigh-in for me was to make this record in different studios with different people, different recorders and engineers, and over a certain amount of time. Just the idea was, how do I get this fractured but not fractured record like the White Album? Hmm. That was the initial goal. The idea was to have like White Album as one disc, mm-hmm. not take away the stuff that people think is filler or the stuff that people think is weird, but either disc one or disc two. Just like do this kind of thing where it feels like anything can happen from song to song. And that's not the way things worked out. But that was my initial way in. And once we got in, we realized that by asking these people to be on this record and different people to work on the record, we were like getting together a group of people that we'd admired for years and that had been inspirations to us. And suddenly we realized that we were sort of putting together this group of people that have sort of worked under the radar for most of their lives, and they did it for the love of music. And so that became the idea. We went from the Beatles to that idea.
You assembled quite a crew. I guess, how did you go about doing that when you were thinking about the people that you wanted to involve?
You know, we had talked about doing a session with Steve Albini. That was maybe the first thing we thought of. And then Andy Gerber, who we'd done tons of records with, I had done a harmony for the song called Winter Western. And Andy was like, you know what? You should get Julianna Hatfield to sing on this. Hmm. I was like, nah, I don't know if she'll want to do it, you know? And he's like, of course she'll do it. Just reach out to her. And she did it. And I was like, oh, cool. And then once that happened, we started talking to other people, you know, John Haggerty and John McCauley. And then we were looking for somebody to mix it, and it was like, how about Jay Robbins, you know? Right. It was like all these people that, listening to their music years ago, I never thought that, you know, they'd be on this record.
Yeah, I love what I've heard from the new album, by the way. I think it's some of the best stuff you guys have done. I really like it.
Thanks.
How does it feel to have a record coming out right now?
Well, that's an interesting thing. And, you know, when we had to cancel the tour and we're driving back, and Ryan's like, man, have you ever seen anything like this? And I was going to say no, but then I thought, well, we actually have kind of gone through something like this with 9/11, where our record was supposed to come out like a week after 9/11. Hmm. And then they pushed it. They said, nobody's putting out records. Nobody, you know, this is a moment where everybody's scared and nobody's going to want to listen to new music and everything like that. So they pushed our record back to the next year, and dates got canceled, and everyone was really freaked out. And I was kind of like, oh yeah, that's what this is like. And it's turned out to be much worse, but even still, we're not pushing the record back. I mean, it seems like people do want to hear music because they can't go out and band together the way people did in the wake of 9/11. It's weird, we've kind of almost been in this situation before. Mm-hmm. And at the time it felt like, oh my God, this is terrible. How are we ever gonna get through this? And you just do. Life goes on, and in the end, nobody really gives a shit about your shitty little record. And they shouldn't. because suddenly you realize there are bigger issues. For us, it's almost like it's just kept us sane. It's given me something to do. It's why I don't feel freaked out. It's certainly done me a world of good. And beyond that, I don't know how much control I have over it.
Yeah.
You get a sense of who's important, what's important, and hopefully people will realize what you had by just being able to go out and see other people, be in a room, and actually be present.
Well, hey, Scott, I appreciate you taking the time. It was good speaking with you.
Good speaking with you. No problem. You stay safe, okay?
All right, cool. You too. I want to thank Scott for his time and his thoughts and his persistence through the years. It's a nice reminder that keeping your head down, putting the work in, and staying grounded usually leads to good things. For example, Lifers, which is a really great record. All the tracks you heard were used with Scott's permission. And all of them, except for Bound for the Floor, are from the new LP. So give it a spin. And go see Local H live when the world reopens. All of the other sounds on this podcast were done by me. I'm McKeegan Boyce. Community Matters is a production of Grey Matter, where our mission is to build meaningful engagement through human-based music discovery. For more info, you can follow the link in the podcast description. For more evidence of music community, subscribe to the Grey Matter blog on Medium. Check us out at graymatter.fm or follow us on Instagram or Twitter. And tune back in next week where we'll once again explore why community matters. Thanks for being here.